Fangoria has been at it for over 40 years and is better than ever. This magazine, it's gorgeous and collectible and delivered right to your front door 4 times a year. Each issue is filled to the brim with articles exploring every nook and cranny of genre filmmaking, past, present, and future, with all the most exciting journalists, filmmakers, and horror know-it-alls to guide the way, including little old me from time to time. This high-quality writing will only ever appear within the physical pages of the magazine, so if you want to join in on the fun, you're going to need to subscribe. Don't go online. It won't be there. To subscribe, all you got to do is head on over to Fangoria.com to sign up, and if you use the code KINCAST at checkout, you will save a whopping 25% off of your subscription. That is Fangoria.com, code KINCAST. Now on with the show.
Hi. My name is Stephen King.
The ice is gonna break!
Go see a dead body.
Well, sometimes that is better.
Today on the KINCAST, we have an extremely special pair of guests, two people who I think it's fair to say are primarily responsible for the renaissance in Stephen King adaptations that we've gotten over the past decade. There's actually much more to come from them now, but let me start by welcoming all of you listeners to the KINCAST, our show about the books and the movies and the man himself, who's had such an overpowering impact on pop culture. I'm Anthony Bresnikan.
And I'm Eric Vespi.
And we are your hosts, as always. So let's get right to it with this remarkable brother and sister team. I'm talking, of course, about Barbara and Andy Muschietti. She's the producer, he's the writer-director, but really, they are an inseparable creative team who first broke onto the scene with 2013's Terrifying Mama. In 2017, they entered the realm of Stephen King with the new version of It, starring Bill Skarsgård and a squad of truly remarkable young actors, including Jeremy Ray Taylor, who we just had on the show a few weeks back. It Chapter 2 followed that in 2019, and the impact of those two films cannot be overstated. Pennywise is America's sweetheart. I've got some of the merch here, the handmade knit dolls, Pennywise action figures. He's expanded everywhere now. He's outside of the storm drain and on the loose. Andy and Barbara's movies, they really opened the valve on the Stephen King universe to full throttle. They went on to do the DC superhero film The Flash, but now they are back in the deadlights with a new series on HBO coming out at the end of October, just in time for Halloween. It, Welcome to Derry. So Andy and Barbara, welcome to the KINCAST.
Thank you, guys.
It's very nice to be here.
I got to say, Anthony, watching you hold up the Pennywise merch, it really, I got hit by a pang of nostalgia, because when I was growing up, you couldn't escape Freddy Krueger, right? Mm-hmm. And it strikes me that there's something about generational horror that kids are drawn to monsters that kill kids, right? Because that was Freddy's. Yeah, I mean, Jason, you know, he killed teenagers and whatever, you know, that's fine. They were adults for kids. But they're, you know, Freddy, even though we only see him really kill adults, his whole backstory is about being a child murderer. And Pennywise goes after the children. I don't know. Some psychologist has got to have a paper on why we're drawn to that, you know. And you can even see in like the popularity of Stranger Things, you know, and you know, all that stuff, where there's, you know, maybe it's just, you know, this is how I fell in love with Stephen King's It, the book, is because I related to the kids at the center of it. Maybe having that avatar and putting yourself in that world is the thing that that does it. But yeah, I'm very curious about why they're always like, once in a generation, there seems to be that horror icon that kids in particular love and will dress up as for Halloween and whatnot.
Yeah, it's the boogeyman, right? The kid, there's something out there to get you. Andy, Barbara, what do you think about that? You had an homage to Freddy Krueger in the movie. Isn't it like part Nightmare on Elm Street 3 is playing at the little theater in Derry?
Yeah. I think that you guys are right about, you know, the attraction to these this character, this monster in particular. Mm-hmm. I think the book, when it came out, it caused a big impact because of many things. But, you know, the children as victims is one of them. I think the movie, the miniseries or the TV movie, whatever you want to call it, caught a lot of people. There's a whole generation that watched that movie almost unwillingly because it was on TV, and they were caught. You know, where it's just like, you know, unexpectedly they saw this thing. Normally, other horror movies you needed to, you know, to the go to the movies or rent the VHS or whatever. I think with the case of it, it was a huge horror movie that was on TV, and a whole generation was devastated by it because they were kids, right? I was a little older when the first It adaptation came out, so it didn't cause such an impact. But over the years, I've been talking to a lot of people that are like ter either terrified or they got magnetized to the genre because of that initial experience. I can speak for myself about that kind of experience because I started watching movies when I was very young. I was 6, 7 years old when I saw my first horror movies. Barbie as well. I mean, we were siblings, so we were in the same household. And we were put in front of the TV at the same time every Saturday night at 10 o'clock in Argentina. We grew up in Argentina, and we saw the same movies. There was a TV program, a showcase of all of the horror movies that you can expect from different ages, different studios, different countries. It was called Viaje al Inesperado. It was which means a trip to the unexpected. Turning to the unexpected, and everybody was seeing it back in the day. This was like, you know, early 80s. We have only four channels on TV, so everybody of my generation and other generations were watching the same movies. So it's funny. It's fun to talk to some of my fellow Argentinians around the same age, and we can talk about these obscure movies that we've only seen, you know, because it was at the same day. We can tell the day of that it was, the year, the day, and it was, you know, Manster, or it was you know, the Illustrated Man, or the Omega Man, Fearless Vampire Killers, all these like very weird and different style kind of movies that a lot of people of my generation in Argentina were influenced by, and you know, some of them became filmmakers like us. But again, with this, what I'm saying is that I know what watching horror as a young age feels like. I can only imagine like someone that was 6 or 7 or 8 years old and put in front of the TV and suddenly meet Pennywise for the first time. It's a very, you know, it's a very effective movie that I'm talking about, the miniseries. And yeah, it marked a generation. It left a big impact on this generation,
It left its teeth marks on people.
teeth marks, and whether they saw it or not, because then you discuss with a lot of these people, and it's like, no, I didn't see the whole thing. I just saw Pennywise behind the clothesline, and that was it.
Yeah, in the opening five, I'm out.
Or maybe they made it to the sewer, you know, the storm drain or something. Definitely, it left a mark, and some of them didn't see the whole thing. Some of them did, and they watched it repeatedly. But in any case, it did leave not only a big impact, maybe an attraction to the genre, and definitely a desire to watch more. I think that the success of it, the movie, the ones that we did in 2017, owes a lot to that first TV movie. I mean, apart from the book, obviously, but it owes a lot to that TV movie from 1990 that left a question mark, a desire to watch more, a desire to watch an adaptation that probably was more faithful to the book. And with this, I'm not, you know, I'm not discrediting the movie because it was a TV movie, and there were a lot of things that they couldn't do back then because it was a TV movie, probably. And they got away with a lot, but it wasn't, as far as I know, it wasn't a rated R
No.
thing or anything. So I guess a lot of people wanted to see more, wanted to watch a movie, and also the time that passed from one first adaptation to the second one, it just created, you know, some sort of petri dish of desire where people want, you know, were finally ready to see
Yeah.
a new adaptation.
It created a legend, you know.
I'm
Barbara.
gonna now answer Eric's question, which Andy didn't. I believe that, in the case of it, which is a supernatural alien, let's call him.
I wouldn't call it an alien.
What?
I wouldn't call it an alien.
Why not?
It's dimensions. It's not really planets or.
Okay, it's a
Okay,
dimensional
but
alien.
extra dimensional being.
Transdimensional, right? Isn't that
It's up for discussion, yeah.
the but it's you know I think the perfect victims are the children because of their vulnerability, but more than that, their power of belief, which is what we keep on discussing in the movies. When we go into the world of horror, of more earthbound adversaries like Friday the 13th or Strangers or Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which are more real, that's teens or people in their 20s. But when it's about believing about something that is clearly part fantasy or not, the fact that it exists, it's not necessarily believed by an adult and hence it's ignored. That's when it's the kids that are, the prime victims.
Well, kids believe in Santa. Kids believe in the Easter Bunny. They believe in good things too. But that means they also believe there's something in the dark in their closet. And that power of imagination is hard to reason with, right? It could take control. And I think that's the power of this story.
Well,
And if you're in a it's a very brief, moment in the book, but there's a moment where where Bill Denbrough is together with the rest of the losers, and I believe he says, "What if?" Because he, they obviously there's an investigation and a speculation, and the kids are baffled why the monster doesn't eat the whole of their bodies. There's always like a chunk taken out of them. That's one of the gruesome details, you know. And Bill says, "What if it's not an eater of flesh, but instead of an eater of faith?"
Well, and the whole
Only.
ritual of chewed and all that stuff then comes into play, right? Where it's more of a mind game, and and I mean, and you specifically underline it in your film where Pennywise isn't like, "Ooh, that juicy fingers you got there." He's like, "Juicy fear." He's like, "This is
Yeah.
what I'm after. This is it." And when you and that gives you so much leeway as a horror filmmaker in the genre too, because then you can answer the question of like, why is it always fucking with people? Like, why do you get to build these great tension scenes? Because for this entity, it makes complete sense, and it's why he's so scary. Is because he is all about raising the temperature to the point, where people. You can excuse having like, well, why did he can easily take these kids out at any point, and it's very clear that and I keep saying he and I this is a trap I fall into because in the it isn't it, but it's also if you're gonna gender it at all, it's a she because in the book she has eggs. She, it's like if you're gonna gender it at all. And matter of fact, I think didn't you guys when you were originally casting, weren't you looking at both genders as well? So it's like you knew this in the back of your mind, for
Is that true? Were you looking at
We did.
We were open basically.
Mm-hmm.
We saw wonderful people. I mean, Pom Clémentieff sent us a tape that was incredible, and she was doing Guardians of the Galaxy at that point. So I think she had some help from the makeup team, and she did an incredible audition that was really a contender. She was wonderful.
Wow, that's
Tough. It was,
fascinating.
yeah, it was a tough, but for me at the end, it was very clear. But yeah, we so female, it was she's a female. Ben Hanscom says it, if I'm not wrong. He screams, you know, after seeing all these eggs, he comes back to the losers and says, it's a female.
Which is still,
But
which is a part that I've it always is a surprise. I've read this book multiple times. This is my favorite book. I visited you guys on set. I don't know if you'd remember at all, but I was
yeah.
writing for Ain't It Cool at the time, and I was the guy that brought my fucking It book, and I was like, all right, we got to talk about some shit here. You're like, everybody's like, oh, what's the casting process? What's this? And I'm just like, fuck all that. Tell me about the black spot. The black spot gonna be in this? And you're finally getting to that, by the way, in the new show, which is great. But yeah, so I was the nerd that came to visit you guys on that set and was like really grilling you on all that stuff. But that's something that's never really happened. That final moment is so horrific. Every time I read the book and I get to it when they find its eggs and they're like squashing it, and like I don't, there's something that I don't really feel a point where the adults like are on the verge of breaking their minds, and that is the time when it feels like their minds are about to break for whatever reason. There's something about the way King writes that it like gets at something more primordial, like the little things that are moving through the membranes and stuff. Maybe it's a little bit more of, you know, the Ridley Scott, you know, alien, you know, feel of the story, but that's something that's never really brought up, and I always love that little detail. I'm sorry,
Well,
tangent.
I got a question for you guys though. Like, do you think that those eggs are really there? Because this thing's been
Well,
existing for thousands of years.
that's a lingering question. And lingering question, Anthony, is like, is the spider, is, you know, the eggs are connected to the spider. Is the spider real? Is the spider its real true form? No. I don't think so. I think it's part of a bigger, as you know, of a bigger hallucination. It's a part of an incarnation, because you know, according to folklore, I guess everybody's afraid of spiders. So when it comes to create a collective illusion, it becomes a huge spider. And the eggs, I think, are part of that incarnation. The eggs, I don't think they're material. It's part of the hallucination to scare them all. And because there is some kind of reflection about all across the book about children and having children. And there's a reason why the losers, none of the losers, when they come back as adults, have children. Because of, you know, I think they're terrified of that, right? So, bringing kids to this world where they're exposed to not the horror of it, but the horror of life itself, the horror of human, you know, behavior,
Neglect and
neglect and violence and hatred and all those things. I think there is a subtext that really connects to the responsibility of bringing children to this world, and I think the eggs are definitely part of that, and weirdly it turns, you know, the tables around. Suddenly the losers are stomping on eggs.
You're right.
Is they're stomping on innocent, like, new children, which is something that up to this point it have been doing. We have the losers like gleefully like stomping and kicking eggs because they think it's part of it. But again, I you know, I think it's part of the incarnation.
It's
Well,
a
I
head
think
game, right? It's like you can't kill me because I have all of these, you'll never get rid of all of these eggs. It's a way, another way of messing with them.
Here's the counterpoint though, and I think the way I buy into it a little bit more as legitimate, like these are Pennywise offspring, you know, Bob Gray offspring, because there's a line that King wrote in there whenever the spider first appears, where he underlines, he's like, hey, this isn't what Pennywise actually is, but it's goddamn close. Essentially, he's like, this is as close as the human mind can grasp, which is very H.P. Lovecraft of him. It's a way of bullshitting his way out of like actually explaining what it is, right? You know, because Lovecraft always has that moment where it's like, I would tell you what this monster looks like, but you would, dear reader, would go crazy with fear, you know, kind of thing.
Very
which
effective.
I think is King's way of doing it. But he does say that the spider is as close as possible to understanding what the entity behind it is. So yeah. If that's the case, then the eggs could very well be legit.
Yeah, but I think, you know, to that point, I think that he's right about not confirming that.
Right.
The great, you know, asset or the great achievement among others of this book is creating the sense of uncertainty. Everything is cryptic. Nobody ever really gets to the end of it or to the point. Nobody knows what it is. Nobody knows what it wants. It's all speculation, right? And that's one of the greatest things that we basically, you know, we we are ruining in this because we're you know, we're very arrogantly giving some answers. Yeah, I think there's a reason why there's no and different. Also, there's also diversions. You know, Stephen King might say that, but also at one point there's a speculation that he's a being made of light, right? So the real true form is light. Is it the deadlights? The deadlights are also like an element. How are the deadlights connected to the being of light? Is it the same thing? So those are all questions that I, you know, we've been juggling with as we were creating this new chapter, which is the Welcome to Derry. And because those, you know, big mysteries have been planted on us and they've been burning to us, like my instinct was always like, okay, we're gonna throw some light, no pun intended, into these questions and try to give some answers. But of course, not all of the answers can be answered. Not all the questions can be answered. And I think that we did a good job in just keeping, you know, some of those mysteries unsolved. And if they were like somehow addressed, we created some others.
Well, I think that's what the Stephen King fans are really going to be fascinated with Welcome to Derry, which is you are wrestling with these questions. I think there are some answers having seen the show, I think they're true. They're taken from King's own book, and you're acknowledging, I think, in the same way he is, that some of this stuff is unknowable, but you're pushing the boundaries. Like, why does this character only exist in this one location? You've really stretched your imaginations in the way the readers do. In the very debate we're having right now, like, what's real, what's not, what is this character? That's, I think, if somebody were to ask me what's Welcome to Derry about, I think it's about the question of what is it? And that's what Mike Hanlon was doing. The loser who stayed behind, who studied the history and created the three interludes that make up the backbone of what Welcome to Derry will be. I think people already know it's set in the 1960s. The original It that you made was set in the 80s. You know that time frame shifts a little from where King was writing to make it a contemporary story. But you go back to the 60s, you're going back again, I think, to the 30s with the story of the gang, the sort of Bonnie and Clyde style gang that come through, and then back even further to the turn of the century with the Kitchener Ironworks disaster. We're not spoiling anything here. You guys have been upfront about this. This is the arc of the seasons of the show. But in the first season, it's centered on the Black Spot, which is the story King tells about this sort of juke joint that the black airmen frequent. And Mike Hanlon himself was a black character, and that racism they faced is a big part of the story. You know, King hits a lot of bigotry in his book too, right? There's homophobia, there's racism. Pennywise feasts on all those different flavors. But tell me about wrestling with this mythology and, as you said, like, trying to explore it but not ruin it.
Yeah, well, so you were right about, you know, this season, this not this season, this show, trying to answer some questions, mainly what it is, what does it want, And we used the interludes as a guide. We went into the past, and there's so many questions because it's Mike Hanlon doing interviews to elder people. Some of the things that he collects are memories from his dad. That is Will Hanlon, which is a character in it's one of the kids actually,
Yeah, he's one of the kids in
and
this story, in your show.
one. But we did we had a little depart there because of narrative purposes. The one now also because of the restructuring of the time and the ages. We decided that it was Leroy Hanlon. In the book, Mike Hanlon is in 58 when he's a kid, and he's talking about the memories, some of the memories of his dad, Will, when he was in the black spot, when he was in the military and ended up in the black spot, and Dick Halloran, and so on. So that doesn't fit our in our version. As we know, the losers, it one happens in 1989. So for something that so we sort of move things around, and it's not Will Hanlon who is in the black spot, but his dad Leroy.
Yeah, his dad is the grown up, is the airman, and
Exactly.
Dick Halloran is his friend.
Exactly. And it's really I mean, it's a really fascinating story. It's like multi-generational. Fun fact, for people who remember the opening of the movie with the sheep and the sheep farm, the man that basically is berating Mike Hanlon is his granddad, and he's Leroy Hanlon. That is one of our main characters in season one of Welcome to Derry.
He's played by Jovan Adepo, right?
Giovanna Adepo did an immense job, bringing this character to life. And I forgot the second part of your question,
Well, the
sorry.
question was about exploring the lore and figuring out a way to probe what Pennywise is without ruining it. Like Barbara, I know you oversaw a lot of the writing and like you were there with a lot of these as you guys were cracking the story. This is a rare case. The problem with this book has always been how to adapt this much into 2 hours. But now you've got the opposite problem, right? Is you've got these small chapters, these interludes that you have to expand, not even into a movie, but into a whole season of
A long
television.
form,
So
yeah.
But let
you've
me say
created.
something before, sorry, about the mythology and stuff. So this, as I said before, the three big events in the interludes, which are the explosion of the Kitchener Iron Works, the massacre of the Bradley Gang, and the burning of the Black Spot. That was a bit of a guideline for us to, to structure this new story. They're just, basically a map for us to navigate the lives into the past, but also to create a story that reveals more of its purpose in this planet, in this dimension. So basically, there is an expansion of the mythology. There's an exposure of a bigger mythology, the iceberg under the water that which for what, like the book and the movies are the tip of the iceberg. So I'm really fascinated by the idea of creating a story where we open a window to everything that we don't know about it, and to the point where we're not only in the perspective of our human characters, but we jump to the other side. What is the macroverse? How did it end on this dimension or in this planet Earth, depending what your take is? How did he fall on that, falling star, that rock? Was it a prison? Was it not? Was he banished into Earth? So there's a lot of, of speculative questions that we're kind of like really Shedding some light on it. So again, it's about like showing our the people that love this story what the origins of this bigger story with a bigger, you know, with a bigger glimpse into a mythology and the story. Yeah.
And it's also, basically underlining and driving into the theme. We have a brand new cast of characters and a different decade, but it's still the same shit, basically. It's fear, and it will be the same shit in the next season as well. So it is, it's sadly human nature.
Yeah, to repeat, I mean, it's so much of it, the book is all about generational trauma, right? I mean, that's the whole point of splitting the narrative of between the children versions of the characters and the adult version of the characters, and how it intertwines, and they play with it, you know, in a way that that King can get away with in the novel that you would probably n never work in a live action update where you literally have. You know, have the narrative being told out, you know, both simultaneously. You know, so far every t adaptation's had to split the narratives here. But yeah, the generational trauma is the thing that I think becomes such a boring word for or term for horror these days, where there's something about it being it's able to do that but be fun, right? And it seems like, you know,
Well,
people are using generational trauma to make. You know, to make things sound like more highfalutin in the, you know, in
there's
today's
hope in the
language.
story. You can fight back, right?
That's true.
Yeah, and look at how brilliant King is in this. He's for him, it's the Pennywise cycle. 27 years. It's once in a generation, basically. It is brilliant. So he will toy with one generation, go to sleep, and then go straight into the next one when he wakes up 27 years later. And that's his hold on the bloodlines, basically. And it's brilliant. And when King wrote the book, it was not called Generational Trauma, probably.
That
Yeah. But that's what it is. That's where we are. Look at our wonderful 2025. I guess Pennywise is alive and kicking, and here we are creating a whole new generation of traumatized human beings.
Pardon the interruption, but I have to tell you good folks a little about this week's sponsor. With all the stress and nonstop grind of preparing for my wedding for these last few months, I'm frankly quite excited that we have an energy drink to talk about today, and a spooky one at that. This Halloween season, fuel your frights with G Fuel Energy, the energy drink designed for gamers, movie lovers, and horror fans. Check out the Fear Fest collection, featuring limited edition flavors inspired by your favorite horror icons. Halloween's Knife's Edge, or A Nightmare on Elm Street's Dream Demon, Friday the 13th's Hack and Slash, Chucky's Good Guys, and Ghostface's Stab Stimulant. Collector's boxes include a 40-serving tub, gosh, that's a lot of caffeine, and a stainless steel shaker cup, perfect for your next horror movie marathon or all-night gaming session. G Fuel is sugar-free, packed with vitamins and antioxidants, and built to keep you focused and energized long after the credits roll. So if you're ready to fuel your fear, visit gfuel.com and use the code KINGCAST for 30% off of your order. That's gfuel.com, code KINGCAST for 30% off. Now, let's get back to the show.
Pennywise also weaves that spell that makes people bloodthirsty, makes people angry, and whole countries have gone mad over the centuries. They'll feel some sense of mistreatment will take root in the psyche of a society, and then you get Derry, which is everybody looks the other way when someone's being mistreated. Everybody participates but says they didn't. There's a that mean streak to it that you guys have always captured so well in your films. Tell me about the grotesques of Derry and the townspeople in the new series.
Well, again, it's like, you know, the line that Stephen King draws is blurry in his books. It's like everything that happened in the book is can be caused by human beings, you know. And I think it's very intentional. It's a allegory. Like, it is an allegory, and everything that, you know, the arguably the most grotesque events are caused actually by people that might or might not be influenced by it, because it's actually things that happen every day in America, you know. It's known that one of the, you know, the biggest starting events for Steve to write the book was the killing of Charlie Howard. Is you know, the character that he calls Adrian Mellon, which is this gay kid who is thrown over the, you know, beaten up and thrown over the bridge into the canal. I mean, I think that that's like an inciting incident for him, apart from others, right? He has a lot of different reasons, like inciting elements that he put in the book, but that was one of them. And I think that, yeah, again, that's not influenced by any interdimensional being. That are things that happen in the world and in America everywhere.
Yeah, it's a chicken and egg thing, right? Is Pennywise causing it, or is Pennywise just enjoying it?
Exactly.
He's enjoying it. We do plenty.
all by ourselves.
Yeah.
Now I do want to like focus a little bit on the black spot, because I'm going to retell a story here. When I visited you guys on the set, like I brought up the black spot, and I remember at the time, obviously this is before it became a worldwide phenomena and you guys were making a modestly sized movie, no idea if you were going to get a sequel or not. You were kind of at that point talking, it's like, well, we have ideas. And when I brought up the black spot at that point, you guys were saying that you were thinking of using that as the beginning of the second movie, should you get to make the second movie. I don't know at what point that changed. You know, I think putting Adrian Mellon at the, you know, as the inciting incident of the second movie is obviously the right choice. Yeah. But, you know, but can you talk about, you know, wanting to find a place for this thing? Because this is something for fans of the book. The black spot is something that always sticks with people. There's, you know, you ask people who read the book, because it's not anything that made the Tim Curry version. You know, it's not something that, you know, it's alluded to a little bit in your movies, but it's not, you know, outside of a passing thing, we don't actually get to see it. Now you have a series where it gets to be the focal point of this long form season. So can you talk a little bit about that?
I will say something before Andy launches. I'm briefer, so I'll say. So Andy is obsessive compulsive when it comes to his ideas. So when he told you that he wanted to do the black spot, that stayed in his brain, and he was going to do it at some point. This happens with every idea. Every defined idea that Andy has will come back, I assure you. And I encountered this situation 2 decades later. I'm still like, what? You're still thinking of that? So we finished the 2 films, and Andy is still thinking of the black spot. And here we are. Then season 1 of Welcome to Derry is in big part because Andy had defined ideas that he wanted to bring to some screen. So the black spot came back all the way from 1916, I'm guessing. When was it that he mentioned it?
It was 2016, right? Because the movie came out in 2017.
2016, sorry,
yeah.
2016.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was like, rolled us back a whole century there, Barbara.
I'm aging myself.
It's happening. No, I think the black spot is almost unavoidable. You're telling the story of the past lives of Derry, and not only is a staple in the storyline that created so much pain, but also on the other hand is that thing that hits so hard and it's so painful because it's based on things that happened in America. And talking about generational trauma, but talking about like the oppression and racism. This is part of the story of the history, not of the book, but also part of the history of America. And we thought it was important to bring it up and put it in the story.
Well, so, and part of putting it in the story, though, is also taking kind of a thing where I'm sure when King was writing it, he went, it'd be really funny. The timeline kind of works. Let's put Dick Halloran in the black spot. And now Dick Halloran's a central point. And I can't help but, I don't want to get into spoilers here, but like I can't help but feel like there's a little Dark Tower-ish feeling here where you bring in somebody who's sensitive with the shine to help figure out something that's going on here. This feels a little bit like the Breakers, somebody bringing in somebody sensitive to achieve a goal, right?
Well, we didn't put Dick Halloran in this story. It was Stephen King who did it. Clearly,
yeah, he's in the book.
I remember. Yeah, that's what I was saying. Yeah. Like when he wrote it, it didn't. Yeah. He doesn't have Dick in the book, though. Isn't like they're for a purpose, right? I think for King it was like, oh, the timeline kind of works out, so it'd be funny if Dick was there, right?
Yeah, this was around 30 years before the events of The Shining, so
right.
it's a late 30s/40 year old guy in 1962. Mm-hmm. He the fact that he is in the book. I mean, obviously, if the interludes were expanded into a bigger story, Dick Halloran for sure was going to be a protagonist in that story. So that's what we did. It's like, okay, Dick Halloran is there. What was his role in all of this?
Yeah. What does somebody who has the sensitivity to The Shine, in Stephen King's world, how does that react with Pennywise? This is where you're getting into the hardcore Stephen King nerd shit, which is, I think the strength of what you guys are doing here, at least for my perspective.
Yeah. We kind of put the pieces together, like Stephen King left those breadcrumbs intentionally. I mean, not intentionally for the making of a movie, but intentionally to just, stir the imagination of everyone who was reading. And what we did was just put the pieces together and ask the question, why was Dick Halloran in Maine at that point? And the answer is clear, and you're going to see it in this series from the very beginning. And Dick, there's like the black spot is not his first appearance. The black spot is the end of kind of his story in Derry. There's a reason why Dick Halloran was there. He was called, and there's a whole story that precedes the event of the black spot. He just happened to be there. So it's basically for people who are intrigued about Dick Halloran. This is Dick in the black spot is the conclusion of his whole intervention in a different story.
Jeremy Ray Taylor was just on our show. I think I mentioned that at the beginning, and he was hinting that there was a scene that I think, Eric, didn't he tell us that it was shot with that showed a little bit of Pennywise's origin, where you were trying to explain why people forget things, and that there was a settler woman. And is this accurate?
I can tell you a little bit about it. There was a point in the post-production of it where, you know, we do test screenings and stuff. And of course, you get notes from the audience and cards and comments and everything is taken into consideration. And there was a portion of the audience that wanted to know more about its origins. And we were always like, look, guys, this is, you know, what makes it special. It's like the mystery. What is it? But anyway, we basically indulged in that, and given, you know, the opportunity of doing additional shooting, we created a scene where it's not the origin of it that is revealed, but the origin of the fog. It's the origin of the looking away, the forgetfulness of the adults in this world. And we created an inciting incident, which is basically a woman in 1700s running away with her baby. And what happens, and you know, she's running away, and she, you know, locks inside of her cabin. And what happens next is a bit of a illustration of what manipulative powers of it do, and the origin of this pact. So we created a pact, and you know, it's a mythological, you know, event where we sort of explain why adults don't look. We put it in very like literal words, you know. You can, as an adult reader or audience, you can understand that the fog is something that happens in real life, and it has a full load of different explanations. But we wanted to make it literal, and in this case, it was basically making a bargain with a mom that wants to save her baby. There's another child in that cabin, and basically, it in its some sort of primal form has a hold on her other child, and says, "I'm gonna eat your kid." You just have to look away, look into the fire. There's a fireplace there, and if you let me eat your child, I'm gonna forgive you and your kid and your husband and so and so. So, you know, in a high distress, she has to make a decision. It's like a Sophie's Choice,
It is
and
Sophie's choice. It's literally Sophie's choice, right?
of a choice. And she reluctantly, like, slowly turns into the fireplace and looks at the flames, as we hear on the back, you know, the sounds of it eating the other child. It was very bleak. We put it in the movie. People were very confused about it, even though it's a very powerful scene. They were like, "Why are you telling me this?"
It's funny how it happened to us with a couple of things. When we tried to give a little context to the villain, didn't only happen with Pennywise, it also happened with Henry Bowers. When we tried to give a little more context, you know, origin and you know, a little more nuance, people didn't really want to know. Now it
Well, in the
was.
case of Bowers, we were basically there is a scene where we explain why he's a fucking dick. He's abused by his dad, and there was a scene where basically, yeah, there was like an interaction, a fight, and a beating up, and on the big picture, when you see the picture, you know, I have to say, like, pacing also, it's a reason people don't want to be in a movie theater for 3 hours, unless, you know, unless I don't know what. But normally, the response of the audience on our first cut was like, "Well, it's a little long, you know. Where does it drag?" Well, like, and they pointed out, it's not that they don't want to see it, but you know, given the questions of test screening, they answer, and the answer was like, "Well, our scene, we don't need to. I don't want to know. You don't need to
There's
see."
also a tolerance level with the audience, I'd imagine. And you know, you have so much with Bev and so much of the, you know, the family life of seeing shitty adults being shitty, you know. I guess there's got to be a formula to it, you know.
Gotta be.
It's also, I think, Sometimes it's easier to have black and white. You are, you're the baddie, you're the goodie.
Right.
That's how it is, and I don't gotta think about it. It's that's the way it is.
No,
Have
but
you?
it's nuances are, you know, in a 2-hour movie, nuances are they have a limited, you know, screen time, I think, and it can't you, the more yeah you can make something that defies the pacing and the rhythm of the movie. And by the way, sorry, you asked about, you know, the scene. It's the first time we ever talk about that scene.
Wow.
Consider yourselves lucky.
It's
Yeah,
cool.
you're
Is
welcome.
it so it's never been released as an extra or a...
No, there was at some point a leaked photograph that I lost my head about, and I went to
Oh,
a witch hunt.
I didn't do it. It wasn't
I
me.
didn't. I did not find the witch,
You were
but
on the set, my friend. Oh no, you didn't got you didn't come to the reshoot. No.
No. It was also it was a professionally taken picture, so I was like, where did this come from?
Is this one of those ideas that Andy is gonna keep bringing back around and maybe in a later season
Well,
or
now that I talked about it, now everybody knows. So,
Oh, Jesus, Anthony.
oh
Look what you did.
sorry.
Enough time has passed since the release of that movie, and I think we can talk about that, you know, that scene, that infamous scene. It's a fascinating premise. I'm drawn to it just because it sounds really cool.
Well, and
So.
it sounds a little fairy tale, which I like too, which is, that's kind of a lot of the roots of it. I mean, down to the small door that the kids go through, or the adults, I guess, go
Yeah.
through as well. Where you get a little bit of that, Grimm's fairy tale feeling when you get closer to where Pennywise actually lives. So
Oh, yeah.
yeah, which I love. Speaking of, I definitely want to talk about Pennywise as the presence, the it of the story, the it of the title. When you're making this show, he's kind of the ultimate horror bad guy because he could be anything to anyone. In matter of fact, I think that when you look at the book, I think he says King says at a certain point that the clown is one of the many faces of it, but it's maybe its preferred face. That's the one that it keeps going back to. And is that did that factor in for you guys on, at what point did it become a necessity to bring Bill back into the role, I guess? Because you could have gone this entire series and never shown
Yeah.
the clown because it doesn't have to. And matter of fact, the first episode, if people are waiting for the clown, they're going to get surprised, I think, in a good way, because what you guys give instead is some really horrific
Yeah.
things. But yeah, at what point did it became like necessary for you guys? You're like, yeah, Bill's got to come back at a certain point.
Always. I mean, there was no, I don't think we ever considered not having Bill in this. And if it will, if Bill wasn't on board, I'm not sure we would have made this.
Interesting.
And regarding the character and Pennywise, you know, one of the reasons we make this is because we wanted to shed some light on the origin of Pennywise as an incarnation. How did it become the clown and why? That's why it was important to have Bill, but also, you know, go back to that incarnate to that decision, if you will, of the monster to become a clown as a central figure. And it's all about being, you know, the right bait. You know, he's there. There's a scene that clearly shows why would it become the clown. And it's related to the traveling circus arriving to Derry. And it's related also to Pennywise giving a great show to kids and kids losing their mind about the clown and basically being so excited that it becomes like a Beatlemania. The kids like go hysterical and they just jump on the stage and create a riots. It was Beatlemania. And there's something watching. There is something watching.
Nice.
Interesting.
I know we're going to lose you soon, and you've been very generous with your time. But before you go, can we quickly get from you your Stephen King origin story?
Oh, yeah.
You
talked about glossed over that part.
You talked about the horror stories that you would watch on Argentine television back in the day. But for each of you, when did you first become aware of this guy and his books and his movies?
I'm going to be very brief, but, you know, it enters our radars around, like, him as a figure. I think in 1980 when The Shining comes out, I think that was my first memory. I was like probably 6 years old, and I start here, and that's my first memory of it and of him. And then my first book was Pet Sematary. Pet Sematary. I read it like when probably at 14 or something.
That's when I read it. That same age, yeah.
14, 15, and it just completely like blew my mind and spun me into a weird direction, because I was fucking shocked when I read. And I had read stuff before. My attraction to horror was pretty obvious at that point, and ongoing for a lot of years. But yeah, Pet Sematary.
How about you, Barbara?
Well, we were, you know, we could read any book that was in the house. And, you know, when we were really young kids, we were reading Edgar Allan Poe. And, you know, there's an Argentine Uruguayan writer called Horacio Quiroga that does this incredible horror short stories based in nature. So we were, you know, our brains were pretty, like, porous and open for horror. But for me, the I saw, you know, Pet Sematary lying around because Andy was reading it, but I think the first realize I said was when I was 15 reading it. And it blew my mind because I completely assimilated those, you know, the losers, the characters, yeah, because they were my age, basically almost my age, and because they were facing real peril, you know, and fighting it and winning. So for me, you know, the agency that those kids had was so inspiring, that it changed my life. And then years later, I got to read a wonderful book that is not maybe one of Steve's usual books, but that definitely changed my life again, which is On Writing. And, you know, it talks about how he wrote Pet Sematary, and and it tells you again and again, write what you know, write what you know. And I think we tried to make films about things we know. So yeah, that's my Stephen King story.
Wonderful.
Well, thank you both for being with us on the show. The King Cast probably wouldn't exist if not for the films you made that, again, really helped reignite the passion for adapting Steve's work. I assume Stranger Things did that too. I think it came out a little bit ahead. Do you think there's a relationship between those two giants of
besides Finn? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I heard that the Duffer brothers were trying to adapt it before we did it.
They did, yeah. And when they couldn't do it, they made Stranger Things instead.
Stranger Things. So again, they're Stranger Things is definitely influenced by Stephen King. Yeah. And maybe it, I don't know to what extent.
Oh, for sure.
And and you're very kind, Anthony, by saying that the podcast wouldn't exist. But like, thank you. I think
a lot of things wouldn't exist without the success of it.
Yeah, there's a whole other conversation we could have, but it would be a whole another hour of the show talking about how Stephen King is like his ability to be adapted in the way that his books are written, that are calling out to filmmakers to adapt them, that keeps him in kind of a, you know, an A-list state in when so many other people, you know, will have giants, you know,
He's the man. He's the man, man.
He's the man.
The best. He's just the best.
It's hard to imagine like a world without Stephen King. Who would who would like who would be Stephen King if Stephen King didn't exist? And there's a time, there's a different timeline where there is no Stephen King, and a lot of people that wouldn't have been influenced by his stories. And I think he's a master of in every sense. He's a champion of humanism as well. All his stories are they talk about human characters, and he knows it so well. And to what Barbie said, write about what you know. This guy knew so much from so early. He was so young. He knew so much, and then he only just absorbed more and more and more.
It got better with age, yeah.
Got
Yeah.
better with age, and
But going back to that original Carrie, that's hand in hand with Brian De Palma's movie elevating his success, right? And so there's a relationship he has with the people who adapt his stuff and the way that they feed off of each other, and in a good way, the kind of, what's the term? The rising tide raises all boats kind of thing. And you guys,
There is a feedback, absolutely.
but the way you guys are part of that system, which I'm very happy with, and thanks for keeping him as relevant as possible so we can keep running the show. There's still people that want to know more about King.
He seems to like to play too. There's that book of short stories out called The End of the World as We Know It, which are all about other writers taking a stab at the world of the stand. And as you're creating and expanding upon the mythology around Pennywise and it, I know you've been in touch with him at least, right? He gives you a long leash to play and explore, but does he ever weigh in? Like people who write extra bonus Star Wars novels or video games, they all have stories of like George Lucas coming in and going, actually, the Force can't do that. Does Steve ever jump in and go, well, actually, maybe that's too far, or how about this? Does he offer any guideposts to you while he lets you run free?
He's been incredibly supportive. We have to say, I don't think we've ever gone, don't go that way. But he sees everything, absolutely. He's
Everything, and he gives us his blessings. And the truth, I have to say, like he's in a is in a moment of his journey where I think he wants to enjoy more than intervene, even though like whenever there's something that doesn't not like George Lucas, he would never say like he oh, you can't do that, or the Force is not for that. I saw him, we saw him like really reacting as more, sometimes more like an excited audience member. When we're doing it too, basically we shared what we were doing, and he gave me a little list of things that he would like to see on it. And one of them was the rolling standpipe at the end of the book. But the rolling pipeline is connected to the big flood that we didn't do on it too. So that I couldn't give him. But he did mention, why don't we put like Paul Bunyan? I want to see Paul Bunyan. And it was like, it was so sweet because I noticed that he sort of like for a moment there, he stepped out of being the creator to being an audience member and being excited to watch this coming back to him. And Paul Bunyan, well, I took it, and that's why Paul Bunyan, the big Paul Bunyan coming to life, it chapter two is in the movie.
Oh, and
remember.
Paul Bunyan's in this series too. We get to see the origin of that statue. So
100%.
But
People didn't want it. People did not
also,
want Paul Bunyan in Bangor, in the real Bangor. When we went to Bangor, there was a big uprising in 1959 when they tried to put that statue in. It was a abomination because it was made of fiberglass. It was called like bright colors, and people hated it. So there was a big, a big unrest when that statue was there, and we tried to, we knew that story. But I mean, Paul Bunyan is still standing in Bangor after like 60 years.
Yeah, right in front of one of my favorite restaurants in Bangor, by the way. Timber, go eat there if you happen to be in Bangor, Maine. Timber.
Timber.
Timber. Yeah. It's next to the, like, the
casino.
No, but where it says Bangor, you know, on the big, we have pictures of that mural of Bangor. That's a kitty corner to the Paul Bunyan.
Mm-hmm.
There it's
we gotta go back to Bangor for sure.
Yes, but in summer this time. Can we go back in summer? We went our first time in Bangor before shooting the first movie. We wanted to see what Bangor looked like because it's the origin of Derry. And it was January and people kept on saying to us, you're nuts to go to Bangor.
Yeah, bad call.
We went out in October. It was great because October, the leaves are changing.
Yeah, of course.
It's beautiful. All right, so, you know, it's probably you're busy next month. So let's plan all in 2026. Let's all just go hang out in Bangor. And,
let's do a field trip.
Field trip
let's
it
do
is.
A field trip, yes. Yeah.
With Uncle Steve.
Sure, yeah. Let's call Steve up. Say, hey, Steve, show us around.
There's nothing he likes better than a lot of fans showing up at his door. that is what scares Stephen King. I think he gets asked that a lot.
Well, we've said goodbye to you guys about four times now, but we could talk, you know, your ear off all day. It's great chatting with you, and thanks so much for stopping by the show.
Good luck with Welcome to Derry.
Thank you, Anthony. Right. Thank you, Eric. That was phenomenal. And we can do it again whenever you want.
Many thanks to Andy and Barbara for joining us. It's been a long time coming. I'm so glad that they finally took some time out to come on the show. They were a blast. I love talking with them both. Everybody, make sure to tune in to Welcome to Derry on HBO this weekend. And if you're a KingCast fan, we might have a little something extra special cooking for you. That extra special something? Brez and I are doing a spinoff show that is just us reacting to each episode of Welcome to Derry each week as new episodes drop, hopefully giving a little bit of insight into what's being expanded from the book and having fun while doing it. I don't have too many more details at the moment, but keep your ears out for that. It'll be available via the Fangoria Podcast Network. Stay tuned. Also, I want to fit in a plug for the Patreon. It's the single best way to support the KingCast. So if you like the show, dig what we're laying down, sign up for a small monthly fee, and you will get access to our Discord, our enormous archive of bonus episodes, most of which have never appeared in the main feed, and instant access to any new episodes that drop. So go to patreon.com/thekingcast and sign up. That's patreon.com/thekingcast. Until next time, adios, folks. The KingCast is hosted by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Anthony Bresnikan. The show is produced by myself as well as Abby Goel and Tara Ansley, and is distributed by the Fangoria Podcast Network. Daniel Danger is our art director, and the show was created by me, the late, great Scott Wampler.